feet. "Give me a minute, boys, to give the order, then we can get down to some serious drinking." The soldiers ogled him. The general was not only standing erect with perfect ease, he wasn't even swaying. Belisarius strode toward Valentinian and Anastasius. His two cataphracts had remained on their horses, sweating rivers in the hot sun, glaring resentfully at the Constantinople troops. In a loud voice, he called out to them, "Pass the word to Morris. We'll take a break for the rest of the day. Resume the march tomorrow morning." He began to turn away, waving his hand in a gesture of dismissal. Then, as if taken by a sudden happy thought, added, "And tell my servants to bring some wine. Plenty of it. Enough for all of us. Good vintage, too, do you hear? I'll have no swill for these men." By the time the servants appeared, leading a small mule train carrying many large amphorae, the encampment of the Constantinople troops had turned into a cheerful celebration. The audience surrounding the general had grown much, much larger. Dozens of common soldiers, hundreds counting those milling on the edges, had crowded around the sub-officers in the inner circle. When the sun fell, Belisarius ordered the canopy dismantled so that all of his soldiers could hear him better. That done, he continued his tales. Tales of Malwa treasure and Malwa military incompetence, of course. But woven among those tunes were other melodies as well. He spoke of the huge numbers of the Malwa, which could only be thwarted by discipline and spirited troops, of the valor of their Persian allies, and the imperative necessity of not offending them with misconduct, of his own nature as a general, good-hearted, but when necessary, firm. But most of all, as the evening progressed, he spoke of Rome. Rome and its thousand years of glory. Rome, often defeated in battle, rarely in war. Rome, savage when it needed to be, but in the end an empire of laws, whose very emperor, and here his troops suddenly remembered with not a little awe, that the genial man sharing their cups was the emperor's own father, only ruled with the consent of the governed, especially the consent of those valiant men whose blood and courage had forged Rome and kept it safe through the centuries, the very men who shared his wine. He drained his last cup. "I believe I've had enough," he announced. He rose to his feet slowly, carefully, but without staggering, and eyed his horse. "Fuck it," he muttered. "Too far to ride." He turned toward Agathias. "With your permission, Kiliarch, I'd like to make my bed here tonight." Agathias's eyes widened. He rose himself rather shakily and stared about. He seemed both startled and a bit embarrassed. "We don't have much in the way of..." Belisarius casually waved his hand. "A blanket'll do. Often enough I've used my saddle for a pillow on campaign." Two decarchs hastily scrambled about, digging up the best blanket they could find. As they saw to that task, Belisarius straightened and said very loudly, "If there is any request that you have, make it now. It will be granted, if it is within my power to do so." There was a moment's hesitation. Then a hecatontarch cleared his throat and said, "It's about the men your Thracians have been dragging alongside us." A little mutter of agreement swept the crowd. There was resentment in that mutter, even some anger, but nothing in the way of hot fury. Agathias spoke very firmly. "Those boys were a bad lot, sir. We all knew it. Wasn't the first time they mistreated folk. Still, shouldn't be dragged," someone complained. A different voice spoke. "Fuck that. A stinking, filthy bunch they were, and you all know it." The man who had spoken rose. "Drag them all you want, sir. Just don't do it next to us. It's not right." The mutter which swept the crowd was more in the nature of a growl now. Belisarius nodded. "Fair enough. I'll have them buried first thing in the morning. A Christian burial, if I can find a priest to do the rites." The soldier nearby snorted. "Fat lot of good that'll do them once Satan gives them the eye." A ripple of laughter swept the encampment. Belisarius smiled himself, but said, "That's for the Lord to decide, not us. They'll have a Christian burial." He paused and spoke again. His powerful voice was low-pitched, but carried very well. Very well. There will be no more of this business. He made no threats. The hundreds of soldiers who heard him noted the absence of threats and appreciated it. They also understood and appreciated now that their general was not a man who issued threats. But that came to it. He would have half an army drag the corpses of the other half, if that was what it took to make it his army. Yes, sir, came from many throats. My name is Belisarius. I am your general. Yes, sir, came from all throats. The next morning, shortly after the army resumed its march, a courier arrived from the Persian forces who had gone ahead. The courier had been sent back by Kurush to inquire, delicately, as to the current state of the Roman army. Belisarius was not there to meet the courier. He was spending the day marching in the company of his Constantinople troops. But Mara surprised the Persian of the recent developments. After the courier returned to Kurush's tent that evening and related the tale, the young Persian commander managed to restrain himself until the courier was gone. Then, with only his uncle for an audience, he exploded. I can't believe it, he hissed. The man is utterly mad. He deals with a mutiny by dismissing the officers, and then promotes the mutineers, and then spends the whole night carousing with them as if... Remind me again, nephew, interrupted Burasminus coldly. I seem to have forgotten. Which one of us was it who won the battle at Minduus? Kurush's mouth snapped shut. That same evening in the Roman encampment, the new Kiliarch of the Constantinople troops arrived for his first command meeting. He brought with him the newly appointed tribunes. Cyril was one of them, and two hecatontarchs. Throughout the ensuing conference, the seven Greek soldiers sat uneasily to one side. They didn't participate that night in the discussion, but they listened closely and were struck by four things. One, the discussion was lively, freewheeling, and relaxed. Belisarius clearly didn't object to his subordinates expressing their opinions openly, quite unlike most Roman generals in their experience. Two, that said, it was always the general who made the final decisions. Clear decisions, clearly stated, leading to clear lines of action. Quite unlike the murky orders which were often issued by commanders, which left their subordinates in the unenviable position of being blamed in the event of miscommunication. Three, no one was in the least hostile toward them, not even the general's Thracian cataphracts. Indeed, the commander of his Bucellarii, Morris, singled them out following the meeting and invited them to join him in a cup of wine. And both commanders of the Syrian troops, the brothers Buzes and Kutzes, were quick to add their company. Many cups later in the evening, Agathias shook his head ruefully. I can't figure it out, he muttered, but somehow I think I've been swindled. You'll get no sympathy from us, belched Kutzes. Certainly not, agreed his brother cheerfully. Buzes leaned over and refilled Agathias's cup. At least you got swindled into an army, he murmured. Agathias stared at him a bit bleary-eyed. What's that supposed to mean? Never mind, stated Morris. The burly veteran held out his own cup. I believe I'll make my own reconnaissance in force on that amphora, Buzes, if you would be so kind. And that produced the fourth and final impression in the minds of the Constantinople men that night. A peculiar sense of humor those Thracians and Syrians seemed to have. The quip was witty, to be sure, but to produce such a howling gale of knee-slapping laughter? Chapter 12. Eusiris, summer, 531 AD. Under no circumstances, Empress, stated the viceroy of Eusiris firmly. Your grandfather will neither see you, nor will he rescind the ban on your travel to the capital at Vanji. The viceroy turned in his plush, heavily upholstered chair and gestured to a man sitting to his right. Like the viceroy, this man was dressed in the expensive finery of a high Carolan official. But instead of wearing the ruby-encrusted sword of a viceroy, He carried the emerald-topped staff of office, which identified him as one of Karolis Matysacheva. The title meant Privy Councillor, and he was one of the half-dozen most powerful men in the South Indian kingdom. The Matysacheva was slender, the viceroy corpulent. Otherwise, their appearance was similar and quite typical of Carolan's. Carolat was a Dravidian land. Its people were small and very dark-skinned, almost as dark as Africans. Shakuntala's own size and skin color, along with her lustrous black eyes, were inherited from her Carolan mother. The Matysacheva's name was Ganapati. The moment Shakuntala had seen him, sitting next to the viceroy in his audience chamber, she understood the significance of his presence. She remembered Ganapati. 10 years before, at the age of 9, she had spent a pleasant 6 months in Vanji, the capital city in the interior. At the time, she had been the daughter of the great emperor of Andhra, visiting her mother's family. She had been well received then, even doted upon, and by none more so than her grandfather. But even then, there had been times that a headstrong girl had to be held in check. Whenever such times came, it had always been Ganapati who was sent to do the deed. Andhra was gone now, crushed under the Malwa heel. But she was quite sure that Ganapati retained his old special post, saying no for the king of Kerala. Ganapati cleared his throat. The king, your grandfather, is in a difficult situation. Very difficult. The Malwa Empire is not directly threatening us, nor are they likely to in the foreseeable future. Malwa's ambitions in the Deccan seem to have been satisfied by their, he grimaced apologetically, conquest of your father's realm. And now their attention is focused to the northwest. Their recent invasion of Persia, from our point of view, was a blessing. The great bulk of their army is tied up there, unavailable for use against the independent South Indian monarchies. Persia will not fall easily, not even to the Malwa. The viceroy leaned forward, interjecting earnestly. That's especially true in light of the newest development. According to the most recent reports, it seems that the Roman Empire will throw its weight on the side of the Aryans. Their most prestigious general, in fact, is apparently leading an army into Persia, a man by the name of Belisarius. As Ganapati says, the Malwa Empire is now embroiled in a war which will last for years, decades, even. Ganapati cleared his throat. Under these circumstances, the obvious course of action for Kerala is to do nothing that might aggravate the Malwa. They are oriented northwest, not south. Let us keep it that way. Dadaji Holkar interrupted. That is only true for the immediate period, Matysacheva. The time will come when Malwa will resume its march to the south. They will not rest until they have conquered all of India. Ganapati gave Shakuntala's advisor a cold stare. For all of Holkar's decorum and obvious erudition, the Carolan councillor suspected that the headstrong empress in exile had chosen a most unsuitable man to be her advisor. The impetuous child had even named the man as her Peshwa, as if her ridiculous government in exile needed a premier. The Matysacheva sniffed. No doubt Holkar was Brahmin, as Maratha counted such things. But Maratha blood claims were threadbare at best. Like all Maratha, Holkar was a deeply polluted individual. Still, Ganapati was a diplomat, so he responded politely. That is perhaps true, he said, although I think it's unwise to believe we can read the future. Who really knows Malwa's ultimate aims? He held up a hand, forestalling Shakuntala's angry outburst. Please, Your Majesty, let us not quarrel over the point. Even if your advisor's assessment is accurate, it changes nothing. Malwa intentions are one thing. Their capabilities are another. Let us suppose for a moment that the Malwa succeed in their conquest of Persia. They will be exhausted by the effort and preoccupied with the task of administering vast and newly subjugated territories. He leaned back in his chair, exuding self-satisfaction. Either way, you see, Malwa poses no danger to Kerala, so long as we do not provoke them. The Matysacheva frowned, casting a stony glance at Holkar. Unfortunately, the recent actions of the Maratha rebels are stirring up the... They are not rebels, snapped Shakuntala. They are Andhra loyalists fighting to restore the legitimate power to the Deccan, which is me. I am the rightful ruler of Andhra, not the Malwa invaders. For a moment, Ganapati was nonplussed.
Well, yes, perhaps, in the best of all worlds.
But we do not live in that world, Empress. The frown returned. The fact is that Malwa has conquered Andhra. In that world, the real world, Raghunath Rao and his little band of outlaws...
Not so little, interjected Holker.
And hardly outlaws. Speaking of new developments, we just received word yesterday that Rao has seized the city of Deogiri after overwhelming the large Malwa garrison. Ganapati and the Viceroy jerked erect in their chairs.
What?
Demanded the Viceroy.
Deogiri?
Madness, muttered the Matasachiva.
Utter madness.
Ganapati rose to his feet and began pacing. For all the councillors practiced diplomacy, he was obviously very agitated.
Deogiri?
Holker nodded. Yes, Matasachiva, Deogiri, which, as you know, is both the largest and the best fortified city in southern Maharashtra. The Matasachiva pressed both hands against his beard.
This is a catastrophe, he exclaimed.
He turned toward Holker and Shakuntala, waving his hands in midair.
Do you know what this means? The Malwa will be sending a large army to subdue the rebels, and Deogiri is not far from Kerala's northern frontier.
Holker smiled icily.
What large army? He demanded.
You just got through pointing out that most of the Malwa Empire's forces are tied up in Persia. Shakuntala's advisor overrode the Matasashiva's splutter of protest.
You can't have it both ways, Councillor Ganapati. The fact is that Rao's stroke was masterful. The fact is that he does not lead a small band of outlaws. The fact is that he seized Deogiri with a large force and has every chance of holding it for some time. The Malwa satrap Venandakatra has nothing at his disposal beyond provincial troops and what small portions of the regular Malwa army can be spared from the war in Persia. Personally, I doubt if they will be able to release any of those forces. As it happens, I know the Roman general Belisarius personally. His military reputation is quite deserved.
Ganapati's hand-waving now resembled the flapping of an outraged hen.
This is intolerable! The whole situation is intolerable!
He glared furiously at Shakuntala and her Peshwa.
Enough! He cried. We have tried to be diplomatic, but enough! You and your Marathas have practically taken possession of Muziris. At least 2,000 of your brigand horsemen...
Shakuntala shot to her feet.
They are not brigand horsemen. They are Maratha cavalrymen who escaped from Andhra after the Malwa conquest and have been reconstituted as my regular army under properly appointed officers.
And there are a quite bit more than at least 2,000, growled Holker. My last count, the Empress of Andhra's Maratha cavalry force in Muziris numbers over 4,000. In addition, we have 2,000 or so infantrymen being trained by 800 Kushans who have spurned Malwa and given their loyalty to Shakuntala. Elite soldiers, those Kushans, each and every one of them, as you well know. In short, he concluded coldly, the Empress has a considerably larger force than the Carolan garrison residing in the city.
Very coldly, and a much better force as well. Ganapati ogled the Peshwa.
Are you threatening us? He cried. You would dare?
Holker rose to his own feet. It wasn't an angry lunging gesture, simply the firm stance of a serious man who has reached the limit of his patience. That's enough, he said, quietly, but firmly. He placed a hand on Shakuntala's shoulder, restraining her anger. There is no point in pursuing this further, he continued.
The situation is clear. The king of Kerala has abandoned his duty to his own kin and acquiesces in the Malwa subjugation of Andhra.
So be it.
In the meantime, refugees from the Malwa tyranny have poured into Kerala. Most of these refugees have concentrated in Muziris. Among them are thousands of superb Maratha cavalry loyal to Empress Shakuntala, all of which means that, at the moment,
She constitutes the real power in the city.
Ganapati and the viceroy were staring wide-eyed at Holker. The Peshwa was speaking the simple, unadorned truth, which was the last thing they had been expecting. Holker spread his hands in a sharp, forceful gesture.
As you say, Ganapati, the situation is intolerable. For us, as much as for you.
You threaten us, gobbled the Matasacheva. You would dare? You would... Be silent, commanded Shakuntala.
Ganapati's gobbling ceased instantly. Holker fought down a grin. The Carolan dignitary had never encountered Shakuntala in full imperial fury. When she threw herself into it, Shakuntala could be quite overpowering for all her tender years.
We do not intend to occupy Mysiris, she stated coldly, almost contemptuously.
Since my grandfather has demonstrated for all the world his unmanliness and disrespect for kin, I cast him from my sight. I will leave Kerala and take all my people with me. She glared at the two Carolan officials.
All of them. Not just the cavalrymen, but all of the other refugees as well.
The viceroy shook his head, frowning. There are at least 40,000 of them, he muttered. Where will...
We will go to Tamrapurni.
The ruler of that great island has offered one of his sons in marriage to me. He has also said he would welcome Andhra's refugees and will assist me in my struggle to regain my rightful place. In light of my grandfather's treachery, I have decided to accept the offer. She fell silent. After a moment, Ganapati and the viceroy exchanged stares. At first, their expressions registered astonishment, then delight. Then, once the obvious obstacle occurred to them, puzzlement. Gauging the moment, Shakuntala spoke again.
Yes, I will require a fleet of transport ships, at least 150, preferably 200. You will provide them for me, along with the funds needed to carry through this great migration.
Again, the squawks of official outrage filled the room. But Holker, watching, sensed the victory. When it came, even sooner than he'd expected, he was gratified, but not surprised. Following his sovereign through the corridors of the viceregal palace back to their waiting escort, he took the time to admire the small figure of the girl striding before him.
She is listening to me. Finally.
As they rode back toward the refugee camps, Shakuntala leaned over her saddle and smiled at Holker.
That went quite well.
I told you it would work.
Yes, yes, she murmured.
I see now that I really must listen more closely to my advisor.
Holker didn't miss the sly smile.
Impudent child, he grumbled.
Impudent? She demanded.
This coming from you? Wait till the ruler of Tamrapurni discovers that he has promised to aid me in my war against Malwa. And his son's hand in marriage.
He has a son, replied Holker, with dignity. Several of them, in fact. And I have no doubt that he would have made the offer if he listened carefully to his advisers.
Shakuntala laughed.
You are an incorrigible schemer, Dadaji.
Me? You're no slouch yourself, Your Majesty.
Holker gave her a wry smile.
Although there are times you petrify me with your boldness. I thought you were mad to order Rao.
I told you Rome would enter the Persian War immediately, the Empress stated.
The satisfaction on the girl's face was obvious. It wasn't often that the 19-year-old Empress had been proven right in a disagreement with her canny, middle-aged Peshwa.
And I told you Belisarius would be leading their army.
Yes, you did, agreed Holker. That was why you overrode my protest at the insane idea of having Rao seize Deagiri immediately. I had thought to wait until we were certain that Belisarius and the Romans had entered the war.
The humor left Shakuntala's face.
I had no choice, Dadaji, she whispered.
You were there when Rao's courier told us of Venandakatra's atrocities in the Maharashtra countryside.
The beast was murdering 10 villages for every one of his soldiers lost to Rao's raiders.
Holker's own face was drawn.
He will butcher even more in retaliation for Deagiri.
The Empress shook her head. I think you're wrong, Dadaji.
With southern Maharashtra's largest city in our hands, Venkatakatra will have no choice. His own status with the Malwa Emperor will depend on retaking Deagiri. He doesn't have so great an army that he can besiege Deagiri. You know how strong it is. The place is a fortress, and still send his cavalry on punitive rampages throughout the Deccan. Nor can he call for assistance from Empress Gantagupta. You know as well as I do that the Malwa have been pressing him to release troops for the Persian campaign. With Rome and Belisarius now in the war, they will most certainly not send him reinforcements. Again, she shook her head. No, I am right here also. I am sure of it. The pressure on the Maratha country folk will ease, while the vile one concentrates on Deagiri.
And what if he takes Deagiri? Demanded Holger. What then? And what if the Malwa defeat the Persians and Romans quickly?
Shakuntala laughed.
Quickly? With Belisarius leading the Romans?
Holger smiled.
I admit the likelihood is not great.
He cocked an eye at her.
You're counting on that, aren't you?
She nodded, firmly, seriously. I never would have ordered Round to take Deagiri otherwise.
The look she now gave her advisor was not that of an impetuous child. It was almost ancient in its cold calculation.
He's using us, you know, Belisarius, I mean. That is why he freed me from captivity and gave me most of the treasure he stole from the Malwa. To start a rebellion in their rear, draining forces which would otherwise be sent against him.
Dadaji nodded. It is his way of thinking.
He studied her face.
You do not seem indignant about the matter, he commented.
The Empress shrugged.
Why should I be?
Belisarius was never dishonest about it. He told me what he was doing, and he also promised me that he would do what was in his power to aid us. Which, she chuckled, he is certainly doing.
She urged her horse into a faster pace.
You know the man well, Dadaji, better than I do when it comes down to it.
He is the most cunning man in the world, yes, unpredictable in his tactics. But there is one thing about Belisarius which is as predictable as the sunrise.
His honor.
She nodded.
He promised me.
And he has not failed to keep that promise. He will batter the Malwa beasts in Persia while we bleed them in the Deccan.
She urged her mount into a trot. There was no reason for that, really, other than her irrepressible energy.
I was right to order Rao to seize Deagiri, she pronounced. Now we must see to it that he can keep the city.
Chapter 13. The Eastern Mediterranean. Summer, 531 AD. The expedition which set sail from Rhodes toward the end of summer was an impressive armada. Antonina had brought a sizable fleet with her from Constantinople to begin with. She had enough transport ships to carry her grenadiers, the 500 Bucellarii under Ashot's command, and the infantrymen from the army of Syria who would embark later at Seleucia. The transports, all of them merchant sailing vessels, were escorted by two dromons, the oared warships favored by the Roman navy. She'd even requisitioned three of the great grain ships. The merchant combines which financed those ships had complained bitterly, despite Antonina's generous compensation, but the Empress Theodora had cowed them into submission, quite easily. A simple frown, a purse of the lips, a glance at the Grand Justiciar. The merchants had suddenly discovered their compensation was quite ample, thank you. The huge grain haulers slowed her fleet considerably, but Antonina had had no choice. At a great ceremony in the Forum of Constantine, 5 days before her departure from Constantinople, Michael of Macedonia had presented her with the knight's hospitaller, who had volunteered for the Egyptian expedition. Antonina had been expecting the monks from the new religious order, but not 3,000 of them, proudly drawn up in their simple white tunics marked by the distinctive red cross. What she had conceived of initially as a lean military expedition had grown by leaps and bounds. No sooner had she obtained the grain ships for the knight's hospitaller than a small horde of officials and bureaucrats showed up at the docks. These were staffs, the typically bloated staffs, for the newly appointed civil and canonical authorities of Egypt, clerks and scribes in the main, to serve the new Praetorian prefect of Egypt and the Patriarch of Alexandria, each and every one of whom, naturally, luxuriated in the grandiose titles with which those mundane occupations were invariably anointed by Roman official custom. Tabularii, scrinarii, corniculariae, commentarienses, magister liberorum, magister studiorum, speculatores, beneficiarii, and so on and so forth. They, too, wailed like lost sheep when presented with their crude shipboard accommodations, tents, for the most part, pitched on the decks of the small sailing ships which Antonina hastily rounded up, naturally over the wails of their owners. But they, too, like the disgruntled grain traders, reconciled themselves to their fate. Theodora's frown had almost magical capabilities when it came to quelling indignant merchants and bureaucrats. Then, the very day before departure, Michael had shown up to inform her quite casually, insufferable saint, damnable prophet, that many more knights hospitaller would be waiting in Seleucia and Tyre, and possibly other ports along the Levant eager to join the crusade in Egypt. Three more grain ships were seized, one of them overhauled by her dromons as it tried to flee the Golden Horn, emptied hurriedly of their cargoes and pressed into imperial service. Again, Theodora put her frown to work. Finally, departure came. For a few days, Antonina luxuriated in the relative quiet of a sea voyage until her arrival at Rhodes placed new demands upon her. John had been forewarned by courier of the imperial plan to transfer his armaments complex to Egypt. But with his stubborn, mulish nature, he had made only half-hearted and lackadaisical efforts to organize the transfer. So once again, the task had fallen on Antonina. She scrambled about requisitioning ships on Rhodes itself, and then, coming up short, sending Ashot with the dromons to commandeer some of the vessels at Seleucia until the expedition was finally ready to sail. But in the end, sail it did. With the newest addition to the fleet proudly in the fore, John's new warship. John took immense pride in the craft. It was the first warship in the history of the world, he announced, which was designed exclusively for gunpowder tactics. Menander demurred at first on hearing that claim, pointing out that the Malwa had already developed rocket ships. But John had convinced the young cataphract otherwise. The Malwa rocket ships, he pointed out, were a bastard breed. Clumsy merchant ships at bottom, with a few portable rocket troughs added on. Jury-rigged artillery platforms, nothing more. Menander, after seeing the ship for himself, had quickly changed his mind. Indeed, this was something new in the world. John's pride and joy wasn't completely new, of course. In the press of time, the Rhodian had not been able to build a ship from scratch. So he had started with the existing hull of an Epactrocheles, a larger version of the Roman Empire's courier vessels. He had then added gunwales and strengthened the ship's deck with bulwarks so that the recoil of the cannons wouldn't cave in the planking. In the end, he had a swift sailing craft armed with 10 cast bronze guns, arranged 5 on a side. The cannons were short-barreled, with 5-inch bores which had been scraped and polished in near uniform size. For solid shot, which they could fire with reasonable accuracy up to 300 yards, John had selected marble cannonballs. The balls had been smoothed and polished to fit the bores properly. For canister, the cannons were provided with lead dropshot. "What did you decide to call her?" asked Menander.
"The Theodora."
"Good choice," said Menander, nodding his head vigorously. John grinned.
"I am mulish, stubborn, contrary, pig-headed, and irascible. Menander, I am not stupid."
Had her fleet consisted purely of warships, Antonina could have made the voyage to Alexandria in less than a week, with favorable winds 3 or 4 days. The winds, in fact, were favorable. Antonina learned from John and Ashot that the winds in the eastern Mediterranean were almost always favorable for southward travel during the summer months. 8 days out of 10 they could count on a steady breeze from the northwest. The slow grain ships, of course, set the pace for the armada. But even those ships with favorable winds could have made the passage in a week. Yet she estimated the voyage would take at least a month, probably 2. The reason wasn't nautical, but political and military. The immediate goal of her expedition was to stabilize the empire's hold over Egypt and Alexandria. But Irene and Cassian had counseled, and Theodora had agreed, that Antonina should kill two birds with one stone, or, to use a more apt metaphor, should intimidate the cubs on her way to bearding the lion. The religious turmoil hadn't spread yet to the Levant, but the same forces which were undermining the empire in Egypt were equally at work in Syria and Palestine, and in the person of Patriarch Ephraim had an authoritative figure around which to coalesce. So Theodora had instructed her, as she sailed along the eastern shore of the Mediterranean, to show the standard. Antonina had been quite taken by that expression. When she mentioned it to Belisarius, her husband had smiled crookedly and said, "Catchy, isn't it? She got it from me, you know. From aid, I should say. Although the proper expression is, show the flag." Antonina frowned, puzzled. "What's a flag?" After Belisarius explained, Antonina shook her head. "Some of what they do in the future is just plain stupid. Why would anyone in their right mind replace a perfectly good imperial gold standard with a raggedy piece of cloth?" "Oh, I don't know. As a soldier, I have to say I approve. A flag's light. You try hauling around a great heavy gold standard in a battle someday. In Syria, in the summertime." Antonina brushed the problem aside with great dignity. "Nonsense. I'm not a lowly foot soldier. I'm an admiral. My ships will damn well show the standard." And show it they did. At Seleucia, first, they stayed in that great port for a full week. Two of those days were required to embark the hundreds of new knights hospitaller who came aboard, but most of the time was spent bearding Patriarch Ephraim in his den. Seleucia was Antioch's outlet to the sea. Antioch was the empire's third greatest city after Constantinople and Alexandria. Antonina didn't take her troops into Antioch itself, but she spent the week parading about the streets of Antioch's harbor. By the third day, most of the population, especially the Syrian commoners, were cheering her madly. Those who weren't were huddling in their villas and monasteries, thinking dark thoughts but saying nothing above the level of a mutter. On her seventh and last day in Seleucia, a large contingent from the army of Syria arrived from their fortress in Daras. Most of those soldiers boarded her ships. The rest... With great ceremony, Antonina turned over to their safekeeping the large band of artisans who would erect the semaphore stations between Antioch and Seleucia. Those stations would serve as the link between the coastal network she would create and the Anatolian-Mesopotamian leg which Belisarius was constructing. While Antonina engaged in public browbeating, Irene occupied herself with subterfuge. She traveled secretly to Antioch, and by the end of the week, had solidified the previously shaky imperial spy network in Ephraim's domain. South now to Tyre, stopping, if only for a few hours, at every port of any size along the way, showing the standard. Tyre was a celebration and a great subtle victory. The population of the city was out in force, packed into the harbor awaiting her arrival. She and her soldiers could hear the cheering from a mile away. Standing on the docks, proudly drawn up, were another 1,000 knights hospitaller. And standing among them, the Bishop of Jerusalem. Theodosius, the newly designated Patriarch of Alexandria, whom Antonina was taking to Egypt, pointed him out to her as soon as her flagship drew near the docks. He began to whisper urgently into her ear, explaining the significance of the bishop's presence. On her other side, Irene was doing the same. Antonina stilled them both with a gesture. "I know quite well what it means, Theodosius, Irene. The Bishop of Jerusalem has decided to break from Patriarch Ephraim's authority and submit to that of the Imperium's church." She chuckled dryly. "Of course he has his own fish to fry. The See of Jerusalem has been trying to get official recognition as a patriarchate for, what is it now, 3 centuries? Theodosius nodded. Antonina's chuckle turned into a little laugh. "Well, and why not? Isn't Jerusalem the holiest city in Christendom when you come right down to it?" Theodosius stroked his beard furiously. "Well, yes, I suppose, but the church councils have always ruled against Jerusalem's claims on the grounds that it's a dinky little border town, filled, or rather not so filled, by a bunch of sleepy provincials. Theodosius winced.
That's putting it rather crudely, but yes, in essence.
And what's wrong with sleepy provincials? You won't see them ruining a perfectly good afternoon nap by wrangling over the relationship between the prosopon and hypostasis of Christ. She turned away from the rail, still smiling. Patriarch of Jerusalem, she murmured. Yes. Yes. Has a nice sound to it. In the end, she actually went to Jerusalem, suspending her voyage for a full month while she and her Theodoran cohort and all of the Knights Hospitaller from Constantinople, eager to finally see the Holy Land for themselves, marched inland. A great grand escort for the Bishop of Jerusalem in his triumphant return. Antonina found the bishop to be, in his person, a thoroughly obnoxious creature, petty in his concerns and petulant in his manner, but she took great delight in his persona. By the time she left Jerusalem, the bishop, who was already calling himself the Patriarch, had given his complete and public blessing to her enterprise. By tradition and church rulings, the Patriarch of Antioch had always held authority over that great area of Syria and the Levant which Romans called Oriens. No longer. In a week at Seleucia, Antonina had undermined Ephraim's prestige. Now, in a month in Palestine, she had cut his ecclesiastical territory in half. A new council would have to be called, of course, to confirm, or again deny, Jerusalem's claim. Antonina didn't begin to have the authority to do so. Not even the emperor, without the approval of a council, could establish a new patriarchate. But any such council was far in the future. Theodora would stall, stall, stall. For years to come, the Bishop of Jerusalem would defy Ephraim and cling as closely as possible to the Empress Regent's imperial robes. Show the standard indeed. As her flagship sailed away from Tyre, Antonina gazed up admiringly at the great gold imperial standard affixed to the mainmast. A flag, she snorted. How in the name of Christ could you intimidate anybody with a stupid rag? But the best, the very best, came at a fishing village. Antonina was pleased, of course, by the welcome given to her by the small but enthusiastic population who greeted her armada from their boats. But she was absolutely delighted by the welcome given by the men aboard the much bigger ship which sailed among those humble fishermen. A warship from Aksum, carrying Prince Aeon and his dewas, who bore official salutations from the Nagusanagast to the new Roman emperor, along with a proposal for an alliance against Malwa. Her first words to Aeon were, "How in the world did you get a warship into the Mediterranean from the Red Sea?" His to her with a grimace. "We portaged. Don't ask me how. I can't remember." "Fool boy," Osanus said. "He can't remember because it's impossible. I told him so." Irene to Osanus, grinning. "You must have slapped his head 1,000 times. Osanus groaned. "Couldn't. Was much too weary. Idiot prince made me carry the stern, all by myself." Aeon, proudly. "Osanus is the strongest man in the world." Osanus slapped the prince atop his head. "Suckling babe. Strongest man in the world is resting somewhere in his bed, conserving his strength for sane endeavors." Chapter 14. Mesopotamia, summer 531 AD. The first sign of trouble came just a few hours after the army bypassed Anatha. The town, located directly on the Euphrates, is one of the chain of fortified strongholds which the Sassanid emperors had erected over the centuries to guard Persia from Roman invasion. Burasmanus and Carouche had offered to billet the Roman troops in the town itself, along with their own soldiers, but Belisarius had declined. There was always the risk of incidents with the local inhabitants whenever a passing army was billeted in a town. That was especially true with an army of foreigners. Had Belisarius's forces consisted of nothing but his Thracians and the Syrian units, he wouldn't have been concerned. His Bucellarii were long accustomed to his discipline, and the soldiers from the army of Syria were only technically foreigners. The Syrians were closely akin, racially and linguistically, with the people of western Mesopotamia. And the Arabs, who constituted a large portion of the Syrian army, were identical. Arabs, on both sides of the border, tended to view the political boundaries between Rome and Persia as figments of imperial imagination. Those soldiers were familiar with Persian ways and customs, and most of them spoke at least passable Pahlavi. Most of those men had relatives scattered all across the western provinces of the Persian Empire. The same was not true, most definitely not true, with his Greek and Illyrian troops. The problem was that Anata was not large enough to hold his entire army. He wouldn't trust the Greek and Illyrian soldiers without his Thracian and Syrian troops to help keep order. On the other hand, if he allowed the Syrians and Thracians to enjoy the comforts of the town while the Constantinople and Illyrian troops camped outside, he would rekindle the resentments which he had finally managed, for the most part, to overcome. So he ordered the army to bypass the town altogether. The command, of course, caused hard feelings among his troops, all of it aimed at him. But the general wasn't concerned. To the contrary, he accepted the collective glare of his soldiers quite cheerfully. The animosity expressed in those glowering eyes would cement his army, not undermine it. Not so long as all of his soldiers were equally resentful and could enjoy the mutual bond of grumbling at the lunacies of high command. Sour Thracian grousing to disgruntled Illyrian, sullen Greek cataphract to surly Arab cavalryman. Fucking jackass. Whoever made this clown a general anyway? By the time we get wherever we're going, the moon, seems like, will be too worn out to spank a brat. Fucking jackass. Whoever made this clown a general anyway? 3 hours after the walls of Anata fell below the horizon, Belisarius saw a contingent of the Arab light cavalry he was using as scouts come galloping up. Morris trotted his horse forward to meet them, while Belisarius ordered a halt in the march. After a brief consultation with the scouts, the Kiliarch hastened back to Belisarius. By the time he arrived, Barasmanus and Carouche were already at the general's side, along with Boozies and Kootsies.
"There's a mob of refugees pouring up the road from the east," reported Morris. "The scouts interviewed some of them. They say that a large Malwa cavalry force..." He shrugged. "You know how it is. According to the refugees, there's probably 1 million Malwa. But it's a large enough force, apparently, to have sacked a town called Thalutha."
"Thalutha?" exclaimed Carouche.
The young Sardaran stared to the east. "Thalutha's not as big as Anata," he announced, "but it's still a fortified garrison town. There's no way a pure cavalry force should have been able to capture it."
"They've got gunpowder," Belisarius pointed out. Morris nodded. "The refugees are babbling tales about witchcraft used to shatter the town's gates."
Belisarius squinted into the distance.
"What's your guess, Morris, and how far away are they?"
The Kiliarch stroked his beard thoughtfully.
"It's a big force, General. Even allowing for refugee exaggeration, the Arab scouts think there must be at least 10,000 soldiers, probably more."
"A raiding party," stated Boozies. His snub-nosed face twisted into a rueful grimace.
"A reconnaissance in force, probably."
Belisarius nodded.
"It's good news, actually. It means Emperor Khosrow is still holding them at Babylon. So the Malwa have sent a large cavalry force around him to ravage his rear and disrupt his supplies and communications."
He paused for a moment, thinking.
"I'm not sure Khosrow can hold Babylon forever, but the longer he does, the better it is. We need to buy time. Time for Persia, time for Rome. Best way to do that right now is to teach the Malwa they can't raid Mesopotamia with impunity."
His tone hardened.
"I want to destroy that force. Hammer them into splinters."
He stood in his stirrups, scanning the area around them.
"We need a place to trap them."
Carouche frowned.
"Anata is only a few hours behind us. We could return and..."
Belisarius shook his head.
"Anata's much too strong with us there to aid in the defense. The Malwa will take one look and go elsewhere. Then we'll have to chase them and fight a battle on a ground of their choosing."
A little smile came to Beresmenus's face.
You want something feeble, he announced. Some pathetic little fortification that looks like nothing much but has places to conceal your troops. The smile widened. Something like that wretched infantry camp you built at Minduus.
Belisarius's lips twisted.
Yes, Beresmenus, that's exactly what I want. Comprehension came to Carouche. The young Persian nobleman's face grew pinched for an instant. Then, suddenly, he laughed.
You are a cold-blooded man, Belisarius, he exclaimed, with a sad shake of his head. You'd never make a proper Aryan, I'm afraid. Rustam, Dagon of Dagons, wouldn't approve.
Belisarius shrugged. With all due respect to the legendary national hero of the Aryans and the fearsome power of his bull-headed mace, Rustam died in the end.
Trapped in a pit by his enemies while hunting, agreed Carouche cheerfully. Speaking of which,
the Sadaran looked to his uncle.
Isn't there an imperial hunting park somewhere in this vicinity?
Beresmenus pointed across the river toward a large patch of greenery a few miles away.
There, he announced.
All the officers in the little group followed his pointing finger. At that moment, Agathias rode up, along with his chief tribune, Cyril. Seconds later, the Illyrian commanders arrived also. The top leadership of the allied army was now assembled. Quickly, the newcomers were informed of the situation and Belisarius's plan.
We'll need to cross the Euphrates, remarked Coutsis. Is there a ford nearby?
Has to be, replied Morris. The refugees are on that side of the river. Since the scouts talked to them, they must have found a way across.
The Kiliarch gestured toward the Arab cavalryman who had been waiting a short distance away. They trotted up to him and he began a quick consultation.
It makes sense, commented Carouche. The Lutha is on the left bank. At this time of year, the river can be forded any number of places. The Malwa have probably been crossing back and forth, ravaging both sides.
Morris returned.
The fork's not far, according to the scouts.
He gauged the sun.
We can have the whole army across the river by nightfall if we press the matter.
Press it, commanded the general.
Belisarius scanned his group of officers. The gaze wasn't cold, but it was stern. His eyes lingered for a moment on Agathias. The commander of the garrison troops broke into a grin.
Don't worry, General. My boys won't drag their feet. Not with the prospect of something besides another fucking day's march to look forward to.
His eyes grew a bit unfocused.
Imperial hunting park, he mused. Be a royal villa and everything there, I imagine.
He took up his reins, shaking his head.
Terrible. Terrible, he murmured, spurring his horse. Such damage the wondrous thing will suffer, in a battle and all.
After Agathias was gone, along with all the other subordinate officers except Morris, Carouche gave Belisarius a cold stare.
There was always a villa in an imperial hunting park, he stated. Accoutred in a manner fit for the King of Kings, filled with precious objects.
The general returned the gaze unflinchingly.
He's right, Carouche. I'm afraid the Emperor's possessions are going to take a terrible beating.
Especially with gunpowder weapons, added Morris.
The Thracian Kiliarch didn't seem particularly distressed at the thought.
I'm not concerned about the destruction caused by the enemy, snapped the young Persian nobleman.
Be silent, nephew, commanded Beresmenus.
The Sadaran's tone was harsh, and his own icy gaze was directed entirely at Carouche.
I know the Emperor much better than you, he growled. I have known him since he was a child. Khusro Anushirvan, he's called. Khusro of the Immortal Soul. It is the proper name for that man, believe me. No finer soul has sat the Aryan throne since Cyrus. Do you think such an emperor would begrudge a few tokens to the brave men who come to his aid when his people are ravaged by demons?
Carouche shrank back in his saddle. Then, sighing, he reined his horse around and trotted toward his troops. A moment later, Morris left, heading toward his own soldiers. Once they were alone, Beresmenus smiled ruefully.
Quite a few tokens, of course, and such tokens they are.
Belisarius felt a sudden deep friendship for the man beside him.
and then, an instant later, was seized by a powerful impulse.
You're quite right, you know.
Maresminus eyed him. About Khusro, I mean. He will rule the Aryans for 50 years, and will be remembered for as long as Iran exists. Khusro the Just, they will call him, over the centuries. Maresminus's face seemed to pale a bit under the desert-darkened complexion. I had heard, he whispered. He took a breath shakily. There are rumors that you can foretell the future, Belisarius.
Is it true?
Belisarius could sense Aide's agitation swirling in his mind. He sent a quick thought toward the flashing facets. No, Aide. There are times when secrecy defeats its purpose. He returned the Sadaran's piercing stare with his own steady gaze. No, Maresminus. Not in the sense that you mean the term. The army was beginning to resume the march. Belisarius clucked his own horse into forward motion, as did Maresminus. The general leaned toward the Sardaran. The future isn't fixed, Maresminus. This much I know. No, it is true, I have received visions of the possible ways that future river might flow. He paused, then said, We worship different gods, my friend. Or perhaps it is the same god seen in different ways, but neither of us believes that darkness rules. He gestured ahead as if to indicate the still unseen enemy. The Malwa are guided by a demon. That demon brought them the secret of gunpowder and filled them with their foul ambition. Do you really think such a demon could come into the world unanswered by divinity? Maresminus thought upon his words for a time as they rode along. Then he said softly, So, as always, God gives us the choice. Belisarius nodded. The Sadaran's pallor faded. He smiled then, rather slyly. Tell me one more thing, Belisarius. I will ask nothing else on this matter, I promise. Did the divine spirit guide you at Minduus? The general shook his head. No. At least, no. I believe such a spirit kept me from harm in the battle. Personally, I mean. But the tactics were mine. The Sadaran's sly smile broadened, became a cheerful grin. For some reason, that makes me feel better. Odd, really. You'd think it would be the opposite, that I would take comfort from knowing we were defeated by a superhuman force. Belisarius shook his head. I don't think it's strange at all, Maresminus. There is... He fell silent. There was no way to explain, simply, the titanic struggle in the far-distant future, of which their own battles were a product. Belisarius himself understood that struggle only dimly, from glimpses. But it is what we are fighting about, I think, in the end. Whether the course of human history is to be shaped by those who make it, or be imposed upon them by others. He spoke no further words on the subject. Nor did Maresminus, then, or ever. In this, the Sadaran was true to his Aryan myths and legends. He had given his word, he would keep it. The skeptical scholar in him, of course, found his own stiff honor amusing. Just as he found it amusing that the cunning, low-born Roman would never have revealed his secret had he not understood that Aryan rigor. Most amusing, of course, was another thought. To have picked such a man for an enemy. Demons, when all is said and done, are stupid. Aide, however, wasn't amused at all. In the hours that followed, while the army found the ford scouted by the Arab cavalrymen and crossed to the left bank of the Euphrates and then encamped for the night, Belisarius could sense the facets shimmering in their thoughts. The thoughts themselves he couldn't grasp, but he knew that Aide was pondering something of great importance to him. The crystal didn't speak to him directly until the camp had settled down, the soldiers all asleep except for the posted sentinels, and a general who had patiently stayed awake himself, waiting in the darkness for his friend to speak. Do you really think that is what it is about? Our struggle with the new gods? Yes. Pause, then plaintively, And what of us? Do we play no role, or is it only humans that matter? Belisarius smiled. Of course not. You are part of us. You too are human.
We are not, shrieked the crystal. We are different. That is why you created us, because...
Aid was in a frenzy such as Belisarius had not seen since the earliest days of his encounter with the jewel. Despair, frustration, loneliness, confusion, most of all a frantic need to communicate. But it was not the early days. The differences between two mentalities had eased over the years, eased far more than either had known. Finally, the barrier was ruptured completely. A shattering vision swept Belisarius away, as if he were cast into the heavens by a tidal wave. Chapter 15. Worlds upon worlds upon worlds, circling an incomprehensible number of suns. People on those worlds, everywhere, but people changed and transformed. Misshapen and distorted, most of them. So at least most men would say, flinching. Death comes striking many of those worlds. The very earth itself scoured clean by a plague which spared no form of life. Nothing left except slowly, here and there, an advancing network of crystals. AIDS folk, Belisarius realized, come to replace those who had destroyed their own worlds, created by those who had slain themselves to be their heirs. Belisarius hung in the darkness. Around him, below him, above him, in all directions, spun great whirling spirals of light and beauty. Galaxies. He sensed a new presence, and immediately understood its meaning. A great sigh of relief swept through him. Finally. He saw a point of light in the void. A point, nothing more, which seemed infinitely distant. But he knew even in the seeing that the distance was one of time,